Well, here we are with the Geraldo Babalu. You did an awesome job.
There was a bus that pulled up to a red light, and little Nog tried to feed it a carrot while big Nog was petting it. He thought it was a horse.
Big damn conspiracy! And everyone's in on it!
I heard you're training with Kobayashi. The competitive eater, you know what I'm saying, for this.
Who?
Kobayashi, the hot dog eater. That's who I'm training with.
Aaron Simpson is the 30-something Randy Couture of the 40-something crowd.
What? Jim House, taste my pee, okay?
Go get some Donald Cerrone!
Oh, this is hilarious.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Good.
Oh, there it is recording. All right, good. Yeah, I'm good now.
Good.
Just making sure the little thing popped up. It says it's recording. I'm like, okay, I can go into autopilot now.
Perfect. Welcome to MMA and stuff on halfguarded.com. My name is Matt Grady, and I'm joined by the esteemed Michael Coughlin.
Why are you joined by? That implies that you're the main attraction.
I'm taking over. It's a hostile takeover.
Son of a bitch. It's just how Trump worked. Damn it.
On the show, we cover all the news in MMA, and when time allows, we even discuss stuff. This week, we're going to talk about Bellator 170, what's next for Chael Sonnen, Mike Goldberg's recent comments about leaving the UFC. We might even get into Brett Rogers hanging out at libraries. And then we'll talk maybe what's coming up this weekend. UFC Fight Night with Shevchenko versus Pena. And some other stuff as well. So
wow,
I think
that's a very, very professional opening. We don't do shit like that.
I'm changing it up.
Did you write all that down?
Some of it.
Send it to me.
I've got bullet points here.
I need the bullet points for when I do the plug, the blurb. And I always sit there like the next day going, what the fuck do we talk about? And I'm like,
I kind of killed two birds with one stone by doing that.
I'll see you tweet about it and be like, we talked about this. I'll be like, oh yeah, shit, we did talk about that. I better go change that.
So I was thinking this week we'll do what we typically do, start with the shows from the weekend and then move into present day, then the future. So the really only major show from this past weekend was Bellator 170. That was Ortiz versus Sonnen. It went down on January 21st at the Forum in Inglewood, California. The show was clearly a box office success. They did an attendance of 12,971. A total gate of 1.1 million, and the third best ratings in Bellator history. The only two shows that beat it were the two Kimbo fights with Shamrock and Dada 5000. So it's the third biggest show they've ever done from a gate and attendance point of view. This was a big success. Were you surprised at all with these numbers, or was it about what you would expect for Sonnen's debut and Tito?
It's really tough to judge Bellator as far as, you know, measures of success, because they're so dependent upon ratings. And I mean, Livegate, that sounds really, really high to me. I'm like, oh, wow, that's a lot of money. That seems like a pretty good gate. But I don't know, because it's California. Maybe everything's more expensive there. I don't know. But, you know, with TV ratings, they're so kind of weird. And MMA in general seems to have had pretty good TV ratings. I know the UFC earlier had really high ratings. TV ratings are more difficult for me to predict than pay-per-views. Like, to me, a pay-per-view, the old adage goes, you know, if you're going to be willing to spend $50 to watch something, you're not going to be turned off because there's a marginally interesting basketball game. Whereas if you're watching TV on a Saturday night, you might get, like, you know, there may be a really good movie on HBO. You're watching it, and 2 hours later, like, oh, shit, I missed the MMA show. Oh, well, whatever. But yeah, I mean, I would say in general, I think it's one of the best signs for Bellator's future they've really had in forever, because Kimbo was, God rest his soul, we're laughing at that, monsters. You know, he was always a freak show attraction. He was never a long-term thing, and he always sold on being a freak show. Tito and Chael, while they're obviously hucksters and they're showmen and, you know, charlatans within the MMA world, they're still within the MMA world. You know, Chael, you know, just fought Anderson Silva and John Jones, and he was in line to fight Vandalay and Tito. You know, you can say what you want about some of his success, but he's always pretty much fighting real fighters. I mean, Stefan Bonner, you know, maybe he's not the greatest ever, but that was a guy that was just in the UFC, and if he and Tito had fought in the UFC, nobody would have thought that was like a sham fight. And so for that, for Bellator to be able to draw people in, granted with two big names, but for two big names with a fight tells me that when they have something to sell, they can sell it. There's an audience for them, and that's all you really need in MMA. You're not always going to be able to have big business because you're not always going to have big stars. But if you can have the ability that when you do have something marketable, people will tune in, that's a huge deal. And, you know, this tells me that Bellator's got that. And it also says, you know, in the future, if they want to lay out money for some of these, you know, more UFC fighters who are big names, it might actually work. Now, they're going to have to be certain types of guys, but hell, they're already talking about Chael versus Vandalay Silva, so they probably got something big coming down the pipe with that one.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the problem with how it all panned out was how the main event actually ended. I mean, Tito beat Sonnen with a rear naked choke at 203 of the first round, and Sonnen didn't look good. I didn't think he looked good, I mean, physically and in the fight itself. I mean, Tito got a quick takedown, and then Sonnen got on top early, but lost position and was subbed, like, relatively easily, especially considering Ortiz doesn't have a lot of submission wins in his career. Granted, Tito's probably the bigger, stronger guy, and isn't a joke on the ground.
Usually it's striking. Tito's actually a really good submission grappler. He's done very well in Abu Dhabi at times earlier on in his career.
Right.
But, you know, Chael also
that was 15 years. Yeah, I mean, that was 15 years ago. I'm just saying going forward, I mean, this is supposed to be Tito's last fight, so he's obviously not going to draw for him again unless he comes out of retirement. And Sonnen losing in that fashion, it's not going to kill him, obviously, but from, like, a booking standpoint, you would think Bellator would have much rather seen Sonnen get his hand raised at the end of that fight than Tito.
I think that's fair. But again, Sonnen is somewhat bulletproof. I mean, look, he was clearly, for all of his success in the UFC, he was shown to not be at the very highest level. He's been out of the sport for like 2 or 3 years. He comes back with not a lot of publicity that we saw. And, you know, people are still interested in him. And especially him and Vandalay. You know, you get fights like that where it doesn't matter if they each could have lost 10 in a row. We know that at least one of them hates the other guy, and the other guy plays Donald Trump in the world of cage fighting.
True. I mean, the biggest controversy with the fight and what most people were talking about was the legitimacy of the fight itself and the finish. There's a moment in the fight where Tito looked like he tapped. I don't know if you saw those clips, yeah. But people were saying, like, that was a signal. And it's like for Sonnen to, like, change position or change that I don't even know what he was going for. Like he was going for some sort of choke, and then Tito tapped his hand. And it almost looked like a tap, but not really. And obviously Big John McCarthy didn't see it. And then they changed position real quick, and basically Tito won with, like, a rear naked choke that was more like a neck crank. He didn't really – it didn't look like your typical rear naked choke where he's got the elbow underneath the chin and locked in. It was more like on the chin, really.
It didn't even look like a proper neck crank.
Okay.
You know, you'll see people get neck crank from the rear naked choke position all the time, but part of it also works because they have the body solidified and they have their chest to their opponent's back. They just can't get underneath the chin, so they just crank the neck. And that way you're able to turn the head and the neck using your forearm across their jaw. But that only works because their body is stationary. So obviously, you know, you twist the head and the body doesn't go. It's going to hurt. Tito was almost off to the side with Sonnen to the point where, you know, it was clearly not a choke, and the only way it could have been a choke would be a blood choke, and it wasn't that. And I'm sure it hurt. I'm sure that if something that happened to you in practice, you'd probably tab. You'd be like, "This is annoying," but in an actual fight, That is not the kind of painful-looking choke I've ever seen before. I can't imagine getting the proper leverage. Yes, Tito's bigger, and, you know, he's better at jiu-jitsu, but that was weird. But I don't think it was fixed. I don't think that the guys worked the fight, because it'd be really pathetic if they had to, you know, do a pro wrestling style signal, hey, I'm okay, or hey, loosen up, in a fight that lasts like a minute and a half, and you have like, what, I shoot in, you'll grab a guillotine, we'll roll, I'll mount you, you'll fuck, I'll take your back. Also, because we're working this whole thing, and it's all going to be fake, let's make sure the finish looks like shit. Rather than just have me go underneath your chin in the right. easiest fucking choke in the world to fake, I'm going to make it look weird. Nah, I don't think it was worked or fake in that sense. I mean, it does look really weird. I think there's a very strong possibility that Chael in that moment said, you know, he gets really into the what's good for business deal. And I think in his mind, he's like, yeah, this is good for business. The champion, Teal goes out with his final win. I can get out of here. I didn't take any damage. I can go do my submission underground next weekend and replace the guy that pulled out. And then I'm ready to go against Chael Sonnen. I'll go on against Finally Silva. I'll go on TV and talk about how, like, you know, it's just important for me to get some rounds in. Because that's what he said on ESPN. And, like, he looked completely unfazed that he lost a fight. So it wouldn't surprise me if Chael just said, you know what, this is good enough. Let's get out of here. But, or, you know what, maybe he's just completely legitimate. Chael doesn't know much about jiu-jitsu, and he's got caught by shit.
Yeah, I mean, to me the thing with Chael is, this is his ninth submission loss in his career, and some of them have been weird, like that Paulo Filho fight in WEC, if you remember, like, he yelled, and then he said he didn't tap, and even, like, the one where Anderson caught him in the fifth round with that triangle. He was at the end of that, he was claiming he hadn't tapped. Like, he does some sketchy oddball things in some of these fights where you're left kind of scratching your head. So I don't think it was a work. I think it was just two older guys, one in Sonnen who's got weird submission losses in his past, who hadn't fought in 3 years, who has issues on the ground in those situations sometimes anyway, and maybe isn't is cleaner than he was in the past. I think all of that probably contributes to a weird finish in a fight where one guy's over 40 and one's real close.
I actually don't believe that Chael's any cleaner. I mean, now he's in promotion without year-round testing. Before, he's like, I was playing under the old rules when we could just get tested and we knew what day it was, but now there's a new sheriff in town, so now I'm clean all the time, except for there's a new sheriff in town, but you left town and went to a different county.
Right. I mean, the only reason I say that is because, I mean, granted, he usually fights at 185 and he's a little more cut, but he just looks soft to me, even for 205. Because in the past when he fought Shogun and Jones, he just looked more in better shape. And maybe he didn't train. I don't know.
It could be everything. Again, it's been 3 years. He could be off the gas. He could not care. Chael to me is so far beyond. He's, like, entered some new form. Well, it's not new. It's kind of like a little bit better version of Bob Sapp. Like, he just knows. Like, some of these guys get so into seeing how much money they can draw by being a pro wrestler that they forget that, yeah, you're drawing doing these pro wrestling type of tactics, but it's because you're a real fighter. And I think Chael is like, I'm just going to be a pro wrestler inside of with real fighting. And it's like, maybe that works, except for you got to really fight. And I think maybe, it sounds dumb to say he forgot that, but, and maybe doesn't take it seriously. Because his attitude afterwards, when he's being interviewed on ESPN, was not the attitude of somebody who's a real fighter and who gets upset when they lose a fight. And that's, you know, the guys who are really in there at the highest level, they're devastated. I mean, Ronda Rousey was easy example. She just wants to kill herself. And Chael's like, well, you know, I had to get in there. It's been some time off. I had to get my rounds in. I just had to get some rounds in. And, you know, this is part of a journey and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, dude, you just got choked kind of by a weird thing on national TV and everyone, whatever. It's Chael. I don't expect anything as long as I'm entertained. Who cares? And he did entertain me when he talked about how the only person who had made any money with their mouth was Tito's ex-wife. That was pretty good. And then Tito's like, you're wrong, she wasn't my wife. He's like, yeah, Tito, that's the problem with what he said right there. Not the fact that you married an actual professional cocksucker. is the fact that you didn't actually make it legal. Just dating her and having a child or two with her, that's not a problem. I wasn't actually married. It's like, stop beating your wife. She's not my wife. Then stop beating that woman over there. It doesn't matter. You're missing the point here, pal.
Yeah, their press conference was pretty funny. I'll give them that much. On top of that, Chael, while we're on the topic of Chael, he was also booted from Apprentice this week for cheating. I don't know if you watched the clip of that.
I have no idea what that is. I heard about that.
Basically, he was on the show, and his team had a time limit for whatever challenge they were trying to do. And if you don't finish in time, you're automatically disqualified, and you lose the challenge to the other team. Unless there's like a technical malfunction. So he cut the power cord on the computer they were using with a pair of scissors and claimed that that was the malfunction and why they needed more time. And Schwarzenegger, who's the host of the show now, said that was cheating and he got kicked out from the show for that. To me, it was clearly a worked angle that was scripted because there were like sparks and stuff and everybody in the room was like, are you okay? He's like, yeah, I'm fine. Are you guys all right? And they're like, what happened? Did you spill water on it? It was like so stupid.
How sad is it that show has less credibility without Donald Trump? Like I know it's always been a joke, it's a reality show, but I always thought there was like some underlying, like the people kind of tried or whatever. Now like Chael's doing a pro wrestling like Undertaker type of gimmick on NBC on The Apprentice, so Arnold Schwarzenegger can say you're terminated. What the fuck? Like, that's really weird. Like, reality TV is supposed to kind of be like pro wrestling in the 50s where people thought, maybe it could be real. Some of this is real. Like, when you do that, that's just like a – if you're doing something scripted, that's really bad. Yeah. If I want to watch something scripted, I want to watch something good. I'll watch The Young Pope. That's really good. I don't want to watch bad scripted TV. I want to watch good unscripted TV. I don't want to watch it at all, but whatever.
So – Chael lost to Tito, then he lost on The Apprentice, then he was going to fill in for Hector Lombard against Gary Tonin at Submission Underground this weekend, but Bellator actually pulled him and said he couldn't do it. So
Bellator is stricter with that than the UFC.
It's interesting, isn't it? I also think Chael would have got destroyed by Gary Tonin if I know anything about jiu-jitsu and Chael Sonnen.
He would have been tapped out in 30 seconds by a heel hook. I mean, Gary Tonin will tap out most people. Like, guys who know exactly what he's going to do.
Right.
He grabs – I mean, he's a leg lock master. He's a genius. Him and John Danaher have done wonders with the technique, and Chael sucks.
So what – you think next for Sonnen will probably be Vanderlei maybe in the summer or something like that?
Well, before I say that, I just realized – I actually am now convinced that Chael purposely lost to Tito because it fits the narrative of I lost in Bellator, I got kicked off of The Apprentice too. Like, everything feeds into each other. That's really smart.
Is it smart to be a loser in everything you do?
In Chael's mind, he's getting publicity.
Okay.
Everybody's talking about him. And it
biggest
all,
loser.
And it all flows together. It adds something to the story. And, you know, and he's thinking, you know, everybody likes to see a guy everyone likes the phoenix coming from the ashes. I don't know. Chael, just because he's doing something doesn't mean it's a smart thing to do. As far as who he fights next, Vanderlei would be the most sensible fight of all, be the most best fight for Vanderlei, the best fight for Chael.
Sure.
Vanderlei Silva's kind of a legitimate fucking nut job right now, so I have no idea if he'll ever fight. I don't know if he wants to fight. I feel like he's like the very dumb Brazilian version of Chael, and that like he thinks that I can like fake things or whatever, but he doesn't actually know how to do it at all. And so he just like ends up like I'm gonna fool them all, and then like 5 years later he still hasn't fought. So I don't know what the fuck he's doing.
Yeah, well, he was supposed to fight for Ryzen and got injured. I guess he was supposed to fight. Was it Krokop?
Yeah, he was supposed to fight Krokop in the...
Because they did that weird-ass...
He got the bye in the Ryzen tournament.
Right.
He was going to fight Krokop. He claimed he got injured, and that led to Krokop getting fighting King Mo.
Right.
Which was better.
But, I mean, Wanderlei came back for that weird, like, tag match submission thing. Remember that? He did do that.
Yeah, that, was sucker, but that was fine. And that, again, that was guys, like, guys don't mind doing that stuff.
Right.
You know, it's just a joke, and he's so much bigger. And they obviously were all having a laugh, as right. they would say there in the UK. Hello, Doug. I mean, an actual fight. I mean, if you're Wanderlei, you've kind of got, like, one big guaranteed payday in your future. And
right.
you gotta plan it out. And if it's Ryzen or if it's Bellator, you know that you're for sure gonna get the money once. You don't know about the second time, so you gotta really make it count. And you can see the fights: Krokop or Jail Sonnen. Those are both mega fights, particularly one in the United States, one in Japan. Almost the two biggest fights he could ever have in his career. So maybe Wanderlei does know what he's doing, except for he isn't actually making any money. Oops.
Back to Chito for a minute. I know we're dragging on here with Bellator, but did you think Chito held the choke too long? Like, McCarthy had to, like, pry him off. McCarthy said he jammed his thumb into Cheeto's larynx to get him to give up the choke.
Oh, no, he clearly held it on longer than he needed to. I mean, you could see that definitely. He even admitted that he did it. Like, he flat out said, yeah, I did it.
Should there be some sort of, I don't want to say retribution, but some sort of punishment for Chito for that? Or did you think it wasn't that major?
The Athletic Commission said they're not going to do anything. In their view, John McCarthy was right there. And because Big John didn't request them to do anything, they just basically going to defer to his judgment in the moment. And I think that's a good principle to adhere to. Even if it's not accurate in this case, because I just think that when you're talking about whether a guy's held a submission on too long or not, it's really easy to look at it after the fact. But if you're the referee and you're right there, you might say, okay, I can completely understand why he didn't let go of that choke. Because, you know, a lot of times guys get that choke in and they do hold it after the tap. And it's not malicious. They just aren't paying attention. You know, you're in a fight. The other man is hitting you as hard as he can. So if he lightly taps you, your brain's trying to shut off any concept of a body touching you. So you're going to maybe ignore a tap on accident.
Or I know a lot of guys, you hold it until the ref breaks you up because you don't know if the ref saw it or if it was a legit tap or not. So you hold it.
Well, yeah, ask old Marilla Bustamante when he fought Matt Lindland about how that shit works. Especially John McCarthy was a referee there for that UFC 37. Holy shit, it was 37. God damn, Bustamante was a god. Moving on.
This was really a happy ending if this is the end for Chito. He had his son cage side. He actually finished 3-1 in Bellator. I mean, it was a decent end of his career. Granted, he wasn't fighting the best guys in the world, but he got paid and won a few fights and kind of went out on a good positive note when, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, you thought this guy's going to spiral downward and have a lousy finish to his career. So to me, I was kind of happy for Chito because he ended things on a good note. And considering we probably won't be talking about Chito again until he gets arrested or does something really stupid, how will you remember Chito? Do you see him as a pioneer, as a big draw, or does that latter three quarters of his career just make him a joke?
I think he's one of the most important figures in the history of the sport.
And okay.
It's just, the end of his career didn't go well, but he had, like, the, like, four-year period there or whatever. He didn't win a fight, but they were always against, one, good fighters, and two, almost every one of those fights was really close. Like, he had, like, that draw with Rashad Evans, which he got docked a point for a cage grab in the second round. But it really wasn't, like, a severe cage grab. I've seen a lot of other guys not get docked a point, and if that hadn't happened, he would have beat Rashad Evans at that time. And Rashad was as good as it gets. Right. You know, he tapped out Ryan Bader real quick, which is kind of really more on Bader, a career low point for him. But again, even here in Bellator, Chael Sonnen and what the fuck is his name? Stephen Bonner. You know, those are, again, they're guys he would have been in the mix with in the UFC, and he beat them. So he's kind of gone out. I would say always kind of competitive for the most part in his fights, except for the fights where nobody would have expected him to be competitive. And prior to that, you know, he was one of the guys, him and Ken Shamrock, really, he's more responsible for the growth of the UFC to where it is than almost anyone, because it was his feud with Ken Shamrock and the feud with Chuck Liddell that set every single record in the UFC history. I mean, I've written about it a lot, but I always think it's fascinating that in 2005, every single fight Tito did set a new UFC record. His fight with Forrest Griffin was the biggest pay-per-view of all time. The fight with Ken Shamrock, the biggest pay-per-view of all time. When he had the rematch with Ken Shamrock, it was the biggest ratings in the history of the company. In fact, it was the ratings that beat the World Series, and are being somewhat credited by people as being one of the more important ratings they've ever drawn. And then at the end of the year, he faces Chuck Liddell in the first pay-per-view that ever broke a million buys, was the biggest pay-per-view of all time at that time. This is after, you know, he'd brought the UFC and shown Zuffa that they could make money. If him and Ken Shamrock, UFC 40, doesn't do 150 or 200,000 buys, whatever it did, Zuffa may have said, this is a great sport, but we just can't make money with it. Sold it. And if it had been sold to anybody else, maybe we aren't here right now. So was he an all-time great? I mean, he held the record for the most consecutive light heavyweight title defenses prior to John Jones. It wasn't against the greatest of competition, but it was against good competition for its day. And I think he fought on way past his prime. And so people kind of think, well, was that really his day? But again, he beat Wanderlei Silva. He beat some guys who were pretty good. And when he fought Ken, whether it was a joke or not, people thought Ken had a chance. And Vladimir Matyushenko wasn't bad. And hell, he went into the second and third rounds with Chuck Liddell and did okay there. So, yeah, again, I think he's one of the most important fighters in the history of sport. And when you do a Hall of Fame, he's just one of those guys, a legitimate trailblazer.
I agree. I know a lot of people who weren't watching, you know, back in 01, 02. Granted, the guys Tito was mowing through weren't the best. A lot of times he was the bigger guy, whether it was against Evan Tanner. He's got a win over, like, Elvis Sinosic, which is, like, a kind of a joke of a title fight. But at the same time, that was who it was, though.
If you look at the guys in Pride at 205 pounds, at that time, we're at the top level, 2001, Wanderlei Silva would have just beat Sakuraba, and Tito would just beat Wanderlei. You would have had, who else was, you know, in Pride, it's not like they had all these great guys who were that much better. Yeah, sure. Elvis Sinisic wasn't the greatest, but Evan Tanner was a solid fighter. Matyushenko was good.
I don't want to say you turned the company around, but he was post-Gracie their biggest star for a long time until Liddell really came up and won the title. And for me personally, like, I watched UFC real early, like 93, 94, 95, 96. Then we couldn't get it on my cable anymore. And that was the first fight, Shamrock and Ortiz, the first one at UFC 40, where I got back into MMA, because I didn't watch MMA for really like 4 or 5 years in the dark period there because I couldn't get it. I was also in college and stuff at the time, so I just didn't really watch much MMA then. I still read about it. I still kind of knew what was going on, but at the same time, it's like that got me back into it. I bought that pay-per-view, and I actually had a couple people come over and we watched that fight, and that kind of got me back into MMA before the whole, you know, Ultimate Fighter thing really blew it up. Tito, I don't want to say he saved the company, but to a degree, if that show, UFC 40, like you said, if that didn't draw, they might have sold and gone under. I mean, you don't know.
It's him and Ken that turned the company around. Ken's importance really can't be overstated also in the history of the UFC.
True,
the beginning. But when you add in the fact that he also did all the business with, Chuck Liddell, and that prior to the arrival of Ken, Tito was the guy that held everything together. He was like the only light that anybody could point to and go, that guy means something. There's something there. Everything completely fell apart on their first attempt at making it big at UFC 33 when him and Vitor were supposed to fight one another on the weekend of 9/11 happened. So that had to get pushed back. And then Vitor got pulled out, and then he fought Matyushenko, and the fight went too long and ended before the pay per view. The fight ended after the pay per view ended, so it was kind of a disaster. But again, him and Vitor would have been a big fight. And, Tito was a big star for a long time. And you know, he earned his shit. He fought dudes, he beat dudes, and he did the press and everything. So again, I tip my hat to him.
Yeah, we're on the same page. In the semi-main event, Paul Daly knocked out Brendan Ward with a flying knee bicycle sort of knee at 227. Killed Ward. Like, this thing was brutal. If you haven't seen this knockout, you should go out of your way to see it. After the fight, Daly called out Rory McDonald, which I didn't really like. People seem to want to see McDonald and Daly. I think McDonald beats Daly fairly easily. I'd rather see Daly and MVP. What do you think?
Yeah, Daly and MVP seems like a fun fight. If I'm Daly, I completely understand why you'd call out Rory. Just because he's such a big star. Like, he's just very well respected, and he's at a noticeably bigger, higher level than MVP is.
I just feel like McDonald would throw Daly around.
Oh, he
and
would,
be able to take
Daly,
him down so easy.
But, yeah, I mean, again, if you're a fighter, on some level, you got to kind of believe in yourself.
True.
As for the fight
as for
itself,
a title shot, then, I mean, I don't know. I just feel like McDonald's just I want to say it's a mismatch, and who knows? Daly could clip. I mean, he hits hard.
No, he'd get his ass beat. Daly would get his ass beat. But
I think so.
I mean, for a guy that I've always thought is a giant pussy who just calls people out and demands that they fight basically kickboxing side of a cage and gets upset, you know, I'm going to have to respect him when he calls out a dude that's, well, honestly, he's far and away probably the best welterweight in the company. So, you know, respect to Daly for that. And as far as his knee is concerned, it was one of the sickest things I've ever seen in the sport.
Brutal.
Like, I was watching it, and I remember thinking, this show's kind of boring. And as soon as that happened, I'm not kidding, there was such a release of endorphins in my system that I felt genuinely, like, joyful. Not happy, not excited. I felt joyful. I'm like, I felt happy to be alive. It was such, like, a magnetic moment. I'm like, holy fuck, this is incredible. And then simultaneously, there was some part of me, this little light in the back of my head going, how is this legal? That's
right.
So disgusting. The way he hit him, just, it was on the judge, like the side of the face, just destroying a human being's face. How can we allow this to be allowed in society? No wonder we're at the state we're at.
Yeah, the pictures of Ward afterwards were nasty, too. He had a major gash on the side of his head. It wasn't just like a nasty contusion or a black eye. Like, this knee busted the side of his head just open. It was a nasty gash. Good on Daly. He cut a good promo after, so we'll see where Daly goes. The rest of the televised card for Bellator 170 wasn't anything special. It actually had probably one of the worst fights you'll ever see, with Hisaki Kato defeating Halleck Gracie by unanimous decision. Manny Sanchez beat Georgi Karakanian by majority decision.
Woo-hoo!
And Derek Campos defeated Derek Anderson by unanimous decision to open the show.
Yeah, actually, that first fight, Anderson-Campos, was shockingly good. Like, I didn't give a shit when it started. I'm like, whatever, I'll watch two anonymous white dudes who look like the most prototypical MMA fighters. And they actually had a hell of a fight. Manny Sanchez looked really good against Georgi Karahanian. He threw one of the most blatantly illegal knees in MMA history, to the point where I'm like, they could almost disqualify you for that, dude. Like, all I can think of is he got confused by the new unified rules. Like, I genuinely am thinking he must have thought, hey, he's got one knee up, I can hit him in the head. Otherwise, I don't know what he was thinking. And, yeah, Halleck Gracie should be ashamed of himself.
Did he know he could punch in that fight, do you think?
I mean...
Did he know, like, closed fists were legal, right?
It's funny, because as much as I look at the fight, and I do blame Halleck just because of how he fought, at the same time, it's not like Hisaki Kato did anything either.
Right.
Like, I know you're afraid of the dude, and you don't trust your takedown defense, but, and I guess there's also a bit of truth to that, because Gracie did finally get him down in the third round, and he immediately passed, got to mount, and tried an armbar, so maybe Kato was right to be fearful. Still, though, dude, like, when a guy
I mean,
just...
Kato's knocked out Joe Schilling. He should have been able to do something with Halleck, you know what I mean?
Just come. I mean, he must his I mean, I know his grappling doesn't have to be good, but his wrestling, something defensive-wise, I don't know, man. It's just, that fucking fight was such shit. As opposed to right now, as I'm watching Fyodor beat Heath Herring. And another fight that had that same sensation of, oh my gosh, how is this legal? It's so brutal. I love this shit.
Moving away from Bellator, Mike Goldberg made some waves this week on the MMA Hour with Ariel Helwani. He claimed to have been shocked when he was let go by the UFC, and that Dana White has not spoken to him since he was terminated. Dana did not do the deed and has had no contact at all with Goldberg since he was let go from the company. Do you think there's more to the story? Like, maybe Goldberg's like a dick and nobody likes him? Or is this just another example of Dana White being a jerk?
This is, I mean, all of this has been weird from the beginning. The idea of letting Goldberg go, is, I thought, was stupid. Dana not talking to him seems very odd. You know, the guy's been around forever. Even if he's kind of weird, like, I've never heard anybody say anything really bad about Goldberg. It's not like he's got some reputation as, like, a prima donna, and everybody's like, oh, we're so glad he's gone, or something like that. Even if he's just kind of like a goofy guy, you would still think that somebody had been there. I was talking to Admin Tony, and I think that, like, there was a time there after Joe Silva and all these guys were gone. It's like the only people left from the pre-Zuffa days were, I think, like, Dana, Rogan, Goldberg, and Vitor. You know, maybe one or two other people, but, you know, it's just like everybody's gone. And yeah. So you'd almost think, like, on some level, Dana would be like, hey, man, you know, I'm sorry to do this. This isn't, you know, all my decision. We have new overlords. And I think Goldberg would have understood and wouldn't have held it against him or been a dick. That said, I was watching, or I should say listening to Rogan's podcast, and he mentioned about the changes. And the way he said it was, you know, even, you know, Goldberg's gone too. And he said it so casually in the way that, like, you or I would say Goldberg's gone from the promotion. And I'm like, it didn't sound like the way you'd refer to, like, a friend as being gone. It didn't sound negative. It was just very agnostic, I guess, is the only way I could really put it. So, I don't know. The whole thing is, it's shitty. The same time, it's kind of like, dude, you got paid for what you did. You maybe, yes, it would be nice if somebody said something nice to you at the end. That's just being a nice human being. But, you know, it's fucking business. You know, I think sometimes it's just a job. And maybe you forgot that it's a job. I don't know. I don't really care. I sure just don't give a fuck. Who cares? It's Mike Goldberg. He's going to go announce Minnesota Wild games or something.
No, I'm with you. It was just a story that made the rounds, and it just adds the fuel to that fire that it's.
Oh, I'm not blaming you. I know you got to find shit for me to rant about. I understand. No, that's not easy.
It actually kind of is. I don't even really have to be here most of the time, but to me the bottom line is it's more that corporate, big company, less of the familial environment and culture. And people just being let go left and right, and like you kind of mentioned, dismantling the company to a certain degree. And obviously that's to be expected when new owners come in and they spend $4 billion on the company. They're going to bring in their own people. It's normal. But you would think after 20 years, Dana would have picked up the phone.
Yeah, that's what gets me. It's like, I understand, fine, they didn't want to do like an on-air thing for him. I understand, you know, WMEI 97.3 would maybe object, like, we don't want to waste time, blah, blah, blah. But you would just think, like, Dana is just, like, on a personal level, be like, I don't know, like, maybe he really does just have a business relationship with people. But, fuck, I know, you're in business. You know, the idea that, like, you could have an employee that works for you for 20 years. Now, yeah, maybe if you had to fire them for, like, something bad, you wouldn't, like, call them up and then be like, sorry, I had to fire you, but... If it was just like, you know, if they retired or whatever, you'd probably, like, before they walked out, been like, hey, Marge, thank you so much for your service. I really appreciate that. Because all of your employees are named Marge. And, or Madge. Or Maggie. I just have one version of a name in my head. So, yeah, it's just, I don't know. Maybe it's just something about Dana. Maybe he's just a very isolated, lonely man. I mean, I hate making these big sweeping generalizations about a dude that I don't know, but maybe his friends really, I hate saying it. It seems weird to say his friends aren't in MMA because, like, that's what he always does. But I don't know. Like, Rogan's not going to be around very much longer. You know that. Silva's gone. Fertitta's gone. Like, Dana's got to just be looking at this going, well, I'm getting a fucking big-ass paycheck, and I'll leave the company into the hands of these people because they paid money so that they could fuck up something that was already making a lot of money.
Also back in the news this week was former Elite XC Strikeforce and Bellator heavyweight Brett Rogers. He has been charged with 3 counts of sexual misconduct and is currently in a Ramsey County, Minnesota jail after allegedly groping 2 men in downtown St. Paul near a library and touching a former cellmate in a sexual manner. This is one of the weirder stories I've come across in the MMA world for quite a while. Did you have any thoughts on this one, or what's going on with Rogers? Is he just falling on extremely hard times?
Well, you'd have to ask the other guys if there were any hard times involved. I know you could. The moment you said it, I could like hear in your voice this. Oh fuck, I said that. When I first read this, I'm like, I kind of laughed. I'm like, oh, I should say, when I first reported this, I kind of laughed. You know, like, oh, you know, he's touching men now. He's like actually gay and all this stuff. But you remember he was convicted. I know he was arrested for domestic abuse, beating up his ex-wife. I think now his ex-wife, and he's homeless. And no, it was not like he made millions of dollars probably fighting, but just, I don't know, he's a guy that was on TV fighting, being an athlete. He had a job at Costco before. Like, he seemed like he had a job, and now he's homeless. And, you know, people don't become homeless unless something's really wrong with them. Like, people that are homeless are not homeless because they can't find a job. They're homeless because they have something so wrong with them that not only can they not work or be in society, but their own friends and family don't want anything to do with them. Like, there's something really wrong with you when you get to that point. So for him to be homeless and, you know, now reaching out and trying to fondle men in public bathrooms and at libraries, it's such a very odd behavior. And maybe he's a closeted homosexual, but even if you are, like, that seems like a very, I don't know the gay community that well, but I don't think that's the proper way to introduce yourself, is to, like, look over at the urinal and be like, hey, I'm gay, how about you? Hey there, partner. So I just see this as, like, a symptom of something really wrong with the guy. But, like, so many people that have, I think, severe mental health issues in this country, it's just going to go undiagnosed and untreated. And he'll, you know, the judge will sentence him probably to a month in jail or something like that. He'll get time served, and he'll be back out literally on the streets. And I feel awful. I mean, I don't think he's got a long life ahead of him at this rate. You know, if you're in your 30s or 40s and you're homeless, getting arrested for fondling people, it's a tough road to come back from.
Yeah, it does not look promising for Brett Rogers. Michael Bisping was in the news a little bit this week. He still doesn't really want to fight Yoel Romero. He's looking for a big money fight instead. Who do you think will be next for Bisping? It kind of has to be Romero. I mean, is there a big money fight out there that we're missing?
He'll probably fight whoever's the next interim champion. That's my guess. I'm sure, you know, Yoel will fight somebody for a middleweight interim championship, and then it'll become a big money fight because everybody gets an interim title now. I don't really know who's a big money fight for Bisping. I guess if Anderson beats Derek Brunson, maybe Anderson would be. Otherwise, at 185 pounds, like, there are guys who are interesting fights. Dan Henderson was definitely a money fight, and credit to Bisping for getting that fight to happen. Otherwise, you know, your choices are Yoel Romero, Luke Rockhold, or Jacare, and maybe Chris Weidman, although I think Weidman needs more than just one win. So you're really kind of left with maybe Jacare, maybe Rockhold, maybe Romero. Rockhold's probably the biggest draw of them, but it's not like you're talking the difference between 300,000 and a million. We're talking, like,
right,
you know, 325 and 400 maybe. It's not like a big deal. It's like, I mean, yeah, Romero's a cheater, but they all are. Like, you can't become champion and then decide you want to fight under Mark Hunt rules. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, if I had to guess, he'd probably fight Romero next. But, I mean, at the same point, he's getting a little older. Clearly, he's paid his dues. I think he has the most fights in UFC history. He's got, like, 27 fights. And he's been a top guy forever, as long as he's been in the company, but not the elite million-dollar buy sort of guy. So I can appreciate where he's coming from, but at the same time, you can't hold up the division. And if there's no fight out there, it's like, just fight Romero and move along.
And I'm guessing he will, and he's probably angling either for more money or he's just doing what he does to basically drum up interest.
Yeah. We do have a stupid USADA story this week. I don't think we had one last week.
We didn't, unfortunately. This is where I would insert the USADA music if I gave
it. We need something. It should be like that circus music or something with the clowns coming out of the cars.
If you want to start doing all the post and edit this shit, have at it. You can do all the special effects you want.
Yeah, I don't think I'm interested in that. So essentially this guy, I think he's fought once in the UFC. His name's Felipe Oliveira. He was suspended 2 years. He basically tested positive for methyl testosterone metabolites in an out-of-competition drug test back on January 11th, 2016. This punishment didn't come down for over a year because he did appeal the case. It went before an independent arbitrator. He's the second guy to do this. The first was John Jones, and John Jones got the full penalty 1 year for the drug he took. In this case, Oliveira took a different drug, and it has a harsher penalty, so he got the 2 years. But what's interesting about Oliveira's case was he claimed that there was issues with the lab, and that this particular lab in Brazil that tested his sample had been discredited prior to the test, then reinstated, then 2 months after his test were basically banned again and not lost WADA accreditation. So his case is kind of interesting because it's very possible, by the sounds of this lab, they have a spotty track record at best and have been shut down twice by WADA, at least twice, because of poor results from these tests they've done.
Yeah, it's a weird one. I mean, again, it's more of these people not having their shit straight and just, oh, here comes a dog from outside. Hello, doggy. If you're USADA, like you're an arbitrator, it's kind of a weird one where they probably made the correct ruling, because usually when these labs suck, it's because they're not catching people. It's not like they're being discredited because they're faking positives on guys. If you're testing positive in a lab that is known for being crappy at finding positives, you must have all kinds of shit in your system. So if I'm USADA, I'm sitting there going, yeah, no, they got discredited because they're really bad at finding cheaters. You're like the guy going 100 miles an hour in a 50, and your argument is, well, they don't always catch all the people going 60 in a 50. It's like, well, yeah, but you're still going 100. So it is very odd. I mean, it's kind of a clever legally, it's a good argument. Legally, it makes sense. You're showing the fault of in the untrustworthiness of a lab. That's great, you're undercutting their reputation. The fucking word I'm looking for, I can't think of it. But, just from like a common sense perspective, dude, just fucking popped. Like, they didn't, you can't like fake a positive for shit. I think it's a lot easier just to not test for something as opposed to do a test and have it come up as positive. Like, to fake a positive on a test, that'd be a lot of weird corruption. It'd be like deliberate malicious intent. And who would do it for this dude that no one knows? It's not like it's fucking, Jose Aldo or Anderson Silva would be like, hey, somebody hates me and they tainted my supplement on purpose. Like, dude, nobody knows who you are. I wasn't even aware you'd fought in the company.
Right. I mean, to me, it's a little bit of, like a conspiracy theory. But when you read this lab's background, it is kind of funny. says, in 2012, the lab was banned from carrying out a specific type of test, IRMS, for 9 months after giving a false positive. In August 2013, the lab's WADA accreditation was suspended completely due to repeated failures and wasn't reinstated until May 2015. In June 2016, only 13 months after having its accreditation reinstated, the lab was again suspended from any anti-doping testing on blood or urine samples due to nonconformity with the international standard for laboratories. The accreditation was reinstated in late July after the lab apparently addressed the unspecified issues.
After the lab paid the bribe and got to do the Olympic testing.
As a result of the real lab suspension, all of their samples, no longer sealed as both were tested in the real lab, were transported to another WADA-accredited lab in Utah where the B sample was tested and was found to contain methyl testosterone metabolites. So basically, these unsealed samples were shipped to Utah and tested again and tested for the same thing. So, I mean, it's plausible. I'm not saying the guy didn't cheat and he got screwed over. He probably did. But there's a plausible excuse, and he's still getting suspended for 2 years based on what sounds like the worst lab in the world.
Yeah, I mean, again, legally, it's a really good argument. They've basically violated chain of custody. The lawyer in me says, absolutely, these results have to be thrown out. There's too much of a possibility. You guys, again, they broke the chain of custody numerous times over a year or whatever. But, you know, just the playing a different standard. If we're just playing the Mike Coughlin, I'm pretty sure you fucking cheated standard, then he's guilty. It's not exactly a legal standard. I haven't articulated it into written form and, you know, asked for it to be amended into the Constitution. But, 2 years sucks, especially when everybody's always getting 1 year because they took a different type of cheating drug, and it's just fucking USADA. Like, they have no fucking, they have something weird, and I'm sure they get, it's really about this and that, but it's like, fuck you. Like, you're just, John Jones, first of all, tested 6 months later and got his answer earlier, and he got a lesser sentence. So, this poor fucking bastard has been sitting in limbo for, what, a year? That's horrible. Like, that's awful. Fuck you guys. I guess he would have got one more year then of suspension left. That sucks.
Yeah. Yeah. In upcoming fight news, we've got Bellator just announced over the weekend that they're going to do the rematch no one's ever wanted to see again. Quentin Rampage Jackson versus King Mo, number 2, on March 31st. The one difference this time is they're going to be fighting at heavyweight, which will make it even better. The one thing about this fight was I like some of King Mo's lines, making fun of Rampage for being fat and looking pregnant and that he had D-cups and that he had been training with Kobayashi, the former, you know, Nathan's hot dog eating champion. King Mo, who I don't usually find that clever or witty, was pretty good in this presser. Like, he even had Rampage laughing. The trash talk could be entertaining, but it's not really a fight I have any desire to see.
I mean, you know, their first fight is so successful that I can legitimately barely remember it. I have this vague idea of it being really boring and nobody doing anything, but I can't remember almost any details. I remember Quentin won, and people were like, but then nobody gave a shit afterwards. I think King Mo is maybe the single most overhyped guy in MMA history. Rampage is just, I mean, good gosh. The guy doesn't give a shit to the point where he's so far away from light heavyweight, they're not even going to bother. It's just, how pathetic is that? Like, I could understand, like, you're like 225, right? It's going to be a tough cut, but you're like, hey, you'd make it. When you can't get down to 205 like that, he's got to, you know, I know Mo said he's like 280, but he's got to be close to that or something. Like, what else is going on that he's just that fucking fat? Like, come on, this is awful.
Rampage claimed he had been lifting a lot.
Mo, he's a fucking big jacked up.
He goes, You've been lifting donuts.
Exactly.
Mo was just like, somebody must have prepped Mo or something, because he was on fire. It was good stuff. In other upcoming fights, Derek Lewis versus Travis Brown has been moved from UFC 208, and that is now the new headliner for UFC Halifax on February 19th. That was the show where Stefan Struve had to pull out with an injury, and they couldn't find another fight for Junior Dos Santos. Halifax has a main event. It's not a huge drawing fight, but one I'll be interested to see, because Derek Lewis is kind of developing a name and has won a few fights in a row. And it'll be interesting to see how Travis Brown performs, because he just left Glendale Fighting Club with, you know, Ronda's coach Edmund there. So it'll be interesting to see if he improves and he looks any different. And on top of that, JDS is now being rumored for a heavyweight title shot against Stipe. So it'll be kind of interesting to see how all this shakes out. I don't know how you go from a fight in Halifax against Stefan Struve to getting a title shot against Miocic instead, but that seems to be the direction things are going right now.
Yeah, they must really just have a hard-on for making sure that Velasquez and Verdum fight one another or something, because I guess everybody's life kind of improves here. Like, if you're Travis Brown and Derek Lewis, you're getting a promotion. You're getting that headline of a show. I actually think it's a pretty solid headlining fight. In that, you know, Brown is a do or die, and Derek Lewis is kind of on the precipice of maybe being somebody could possibly care about. And it's a show in fucking Halifax. Again, we've been over this. Nobody knows where that is. It's actually right next to Newfoundland. Because in Canada, and I think that's in between Labrador, you know, Canada names their fucking provinces after dogs. You're fighting in, like, a dog territory, all right? This is not a big, important show. So for them to have this kind of a main event, that's pretty damn good. This is like back in the day when the UFC was in Dothan, Alabama, every other pay-per-view, and you have, like, Vitor Belfort showing up, and, God, what a culture shock that must have been. It's good. And if Dos Santos faces Miocic, that's a good fight. I mean, Dos Santos has won the last fight, and it's Miocic's last loss, and I don't know who else he's going to fight in the meantime. So, yeah, I'm fine with that.
Then at UFC 210, we've got, which is going to be in Buffalo, actually, UFC's long-awaited return to Buffalo. Out since, I don't know, like 97, I think, was the last time they were in Buffalo. But
Wait, hold on. They've been three times in New York since then, though. They did New York City. They did Albany.
Yeah. This will be, and then they're doing New York City again for Rondamy and Holm.
Oh, I thought they did.
I guess that's Brooklyn.
I thought they did. Well, it's all New York City, fuck's sake. I thought they did a third show.
That would be the. I mean, they've only done Albany and MSG so far.
Oh, I thought they'd already been to Buffalo. Oh, whatever.
You're thinking that Albany, I think it was a fight pass card. Derek Lewis was
headlined
on
by Derek Lewis, yeah. Yeah. That's what I'm thinking of. Whatever. Yeah. Fuck you, Jesse.
So anyway, the big match announced so far is Chris Weidman versus Gegard Mousasi. Weidman needs a win badly in this one. And Mousasi's pretty hot right now. He's won a few big fights in a row and looks like he's on the precipice of, you know, being in the title picture. Do you favor either guy in this? Is Weidman kind of winding down and Mousasi's on the rise, or do you think Weidman can pull it out?
I like the fight. I favor Weidman. He's been to the top of the mountain and lost his last. He's lost two in a row. I've seen lots of guys that get hot. They win a couple fights on top, and the way he's kind of fallen, and he lost a fight, and he lost to Yoel Romero in a fight where he was doing good, but not great. And it looked just like he lost a step. And sometimes that does happen. That said, Mousasi's always been a guy that's been very inconsistent himself. He's always just kind of never really put it together when it truly counted. I think it showed an interesting breaking pattern because they almost never did loser versus winner fights. And now you're doing a guy in Mousasi who's on a long winning streak against a guy in Weidman who's on a short, you know, a decent losing streak. And it's, again, maybe this is a sign of the new owners or something like that. I don't know. Maybe this is more Sean Shelby over Joe Silva. It could be. I don't know. I'm validating myself. But I mean, I like the fight a lot. I think it's a really good fight. I think it's perfect for both guys. If you're Weidman, this is a winnable fight, and it's a fight that you would also help your credibility. And if you're Musasi, you're getting a chance at the big dogs. This immediately puts you into the absolute contender slot, and then you can start getting your real money fights. So, and he's, and I think that Musasi's earned that right. I think it's 2016, which kind of flew under the radar, but he was 4-0 with, I think, three finishes over good guys. You know, that's he had a really damn good year, so I think he deserves a chance at the upper echelon. So I like the fight a lot overall.
I do, too. And another fight I'm looking forward to, we've got Khabib Nurmagomedov versus Tony Ferguson in a fight that's awesome at 155 pounds. You know, you've got your 1A and 1B here going at it.
We didn't talk about this before?
We did a little bit, but more came out on it. So it's official for UFC 209 on March 4th. There's one caveat with this fight, though. It's for the interim lightweight title. This seems totally unnecessary considering McGregor just won the title in November. Do you think the UFC is doing some serious damage to their championships by adding another interim title like this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've been ranting about this for weeks now. I mean, it was UFC 206 was really bad, and this just seems like they're just spitting in your eye with it. I was like, yeah, whatever, fuck you. We're just going to do it. We don't care. We're not looking at the long-term picture. We got to recoup our money now, or they don't understand. It's so stupid. It doesn't add shit to it. Nobody's going to see it as real. I think there's only been one time in UFC history where an interim championship actually worked out, and that was when Henan Barao won one. Otherwise, every other time there's an interim championship, like, the guy gets maybe one fight if at best, and then they're immediately the champion. I mean, fucking Jose Aldo won the interim title, and just 5 months later, he becomes a real title. Like, you barely waited a training camp. That's fucking retarded. I mean, fucking Conor McGregor could not win a title and then go to fucking St. Patrick's Day without them coming up with an interim title. They went they'll have gone two pay-per-views. No, sorry, three, I guess. This is bullshit. It's so stupid. Nobody cares. And they're just further making it into a true prize-fighting atmosphere. And, they may think that they're winning. But you know what? The guy who wins the most is Conor McGregor. The more that you make, the more you make this sport about stars and not titles, the more Conor McGregor benefits.
To me, they'd almost be better because you would wonder even if, you know, the casual fan, the average person out there, even knows what title Conor has right now. Like what percentage of fans know he's the lightweight champ at 155 pounds? They'd be better off promoting this as a number one contender's fight. The winner fights Conor McGregor, the biggest star in MMA, who destroyed Eddie Alvarez. Because calling either one of those guys the interim lightweight champ means nothing to the casual fan. And they might not even if they're aware of that fight, they might not even connect the dots that would mean they'd fight McGregor next. It's like they should sit McGregor down and say, hey, we want you to fight the winner of Nurmagomedov and Ferguson in July or whenever, and have him cage side for the fight and promote it based on McGregor as opposed to some interim title that no one even knows what it really means.
Yeah, I mean, that would work because after that fight happens, because remember, most people, you're right, they probably don't know exactly which title Conor has, but they know he has two belts. Everybody knows he has two titles because he was the first guy to ever do it, and they hammered that home so hard at 205. So they know he has two belts. Now, they don't know that he only has one belt now, but they all think he has two belts. And think about this. Assuming he's the rightful title holder in two different weight classes, after this pay-per-view happens, there will be three other people with claims to his titles.
Right.
Two interim champions and a fake real champion. And they all happened after he won the lightweight title. I mean, Jose, I guess, was kind of partway before. But it's like, this is so fucking stupid. It's such a joke. They're lucky that they have so many decades of goodwill built up that nobody's getting confused and that they're all in the UFC, but everybody knows who the champion is. And I mean, you could have just signed this, made it say, we're going to make it 5 rounds because it's a special fight. Something like that. Because I want to see those two go 5. I don't want them going 3. I think those two going 3, it sucks. I think it's a waste. I want to see them going 5. And if the only way to do that is an interim title, then I'll swallow that pill. I don't care. Because I don't give a shit anyway.
But, I mean, they could have gone 5 rounds and headlined a Fox show. I mean, they're doing
they
that.
They keep on the pay-per-view. You just say it's right. The first time ever we're making this a true number one contender. The winner fights the champion no matter what. And again, if they want to just get in the habit, if they want to award an interim title in every single weight class as a way to, I guess, basically call the bluff and force the champion to always have to fight that guy, if they want to treat it like the word interim means number one contender, so be it. That's fine. That's actually a really good precedent to set as long as you educate the people about it. I don't think that they're thinking that way. I don't think they're thinking past next quarter. I think they're just trying to get every dime they can. They're trying to jack up the value of this thing so that when they renegotiate their TV deal, they can be like, look, we have all the champions, we're doing all this money, and they're going to hosh out the shit out of it. And I hope that it's just temporary and that they settle down long term. Otherwise it won't really matter. We're going to still have a bunch of awesome fucking fights no matter what. So I'll be happy.
While we're on the topic of McGregor, the Mayweather-McGregor talk has quieted down a little bit. But now Manny Pacquiao has made the claim that he'd want to fight McGregor in a boxing match. Dana White responded to Pacquiao by saying he would never do business with Pacquiao's promoter, Bob Arum. They have a long-time feud. If you had to watch one McGregor fight, would it be Pacquiao or Mayweather?
Like boxing match?
Yeah.
Mayweather?
You think that'd be a more entertaining fight?
Well, one, he's a little he's naturally a little bit bigger than Pacquiao. Sure. Also, if I'm going to watch an elite world-class boxer beat up Conor, I'd rather just, like, see the greatest who's of this era at that weight do it. Because that way, if Conor did somehow do something, it would mean more. Like, if he knocked out Pacquiao, granted, if he did that, I would just go, holy shit, this guy is truly the greatest of all time. But if he knocks out, you know, if you're going to get knocked out and lose to a goat and lose to Mayweather, because if you do land that one punch, it's even more crazy. So,
right.
Dan, Bob Arum, the whole thing's a farce. Otherwise, I mean, shit, if they did McGregor and Pacquiao, that would do a lot of money. I mean, I think that'd be a $2 million buy show, so they're not going to do it, because it's fucking stupid, because Conor's not going to fucking box, because duh, but whatever, I don't care.
Fair enough. This weekend, we've got a few shows coming up. We've got Bellator 171 from the Kansas Star Casino in Mulvane, Kansas. Big metropolitan area it is.
When you are such a shit promotion that you're in a lesser area of Kansas than Invicta, you got some problems there. Because Invicta has the best fucking place ever. The Scottish Rite Temple, it's beautiful. It's an actual fucking temple. And it's like, you look inside, it's awesome. It's the coolest place in the world. They have fights. It's like a fucking opera house or something. It's so cool. And Bellator is in a place that no one has ever heard. I'm sure it's probably like right outside Kansas City or some shit like that. But for right now, let's just pretend that they went to the bumfuck middle of nowhere, Kansas. Like the good old days when they're going to barnstorm and just have the Amish set it up and then they'll fight.
In the main event, Melvin Gillard will be fighting Chidi Njikalani. The one thing that caught my eye about this fight is it's a catchweight fight at 175 pounds. Gillard has missed weight at 155 four out of his last 5 fights. And Njikalani has missed weight at 170, I think, 3 times in his career. So they just randomly said, let's do this fight at 175. But that's a jump up at 20 pounds for Gillard, who hasn't really looked good in the last few years. Granted, he's only 33, but he's kind of been put through the ringer through the course of his career.
Then 33. Holy fuck.
I think so. Babyface assassin, right? Isn't that Gillard's name?
No.
Yeah, he's 33.
Using the babyface assassin. That's
young, young assassin. The young assassin is his nickname. I'm sorry.
I mean, he did have just an absurd number of fights on the low levels in Louisiana. But still, god damn, he's only 33. I'm so fucking old.
He's got, he's 32, 16, 2, and 3.
Yeah.
he's got three no contests. Impressive.
I mean, he's got two fucking DQs. Like, he has five fights that ended in a weird thing that never happened. Like, that's really weird. Now he's moving up to 175. I don't know if one of them is on, like, short notice. I mean, that's the only excuse. Otherwise, like, this is really weird. I mean, it could be a good fight. And Jaguani is just striking. And Gillard is the midget kind of Kevin Randleman, but, I mean, no one gives a fuck about this fight. This is second from the top on Fight Pass, you know, on a undercard of a average fight night. It's fine, like, I'm not gonna, like, I'm sure I'll watch it, but no one gives a shit.
David Rickles will be there. He might dress up like a dinosaur. Antonio McKee's kid's fighting again. Then on the undercard, I know nobody cares about him yet, but Tyrell Fortune and Jared Trice, both, you know, those top-level NCAA All-American wrestlers, both heavyweights, aren't fighting each other but are on the undercard. So a couple prospects there. But
hey, good for Bellator for that, by the way. Go out there and find heavyweight prospects because, you know, UFC can't or won't or whatever, and maybe they don't give a shit because it was taken from Bellator, but you go out there and they're doing the right thing. They're trying to find young talent, and it's kind of like, you know, pro wrestling. If you got to just go where the other guy isn't and take advantage of inefficiencies in the market, so to speak.
Then on Saturday night, January 28th, we've got a UFC on Fox show headlined by Shevchenko versus Pena. This one's going down in Denver, Colorado at the Pepsi Center. The Valentina Shevchenko and Juliana Pena fight is supposed to be a number one contenders fight for Amanda Nunes. Whether or not that pans out, God only knows how they'll decide to go. But an interesting fight, obviously.
Should be for an interim title.
Every fight should be.
It's fucking been almost a month since Nunes fought. What the fuck?
Shevchenko's been, I want to say clearly, but likely got the advantage on the feet, and Pena's got the advantage on the ground, you would think. Any thoughts on that fight as a main event, or who's the likely winner?
I've kind of gotten into this fight. I just started watching a lot of their fights this week. It's so weird watching these two because everything that happens 135 pounds will always be through the prism of Ronda Rousey. And I'm watching, especially Pena fight, like her last fight, Kat Zingano at UFC 200. And Zingano was just fucking tossing her with ease in the first round, just dominated her. No, Pena showed heart and struggle and came back. And she'd won a lot of fights by basically just kind of being a grinder. But I'm watching, and I'm like, you know, the way she strikes and all this stuff. Same with even Shevchenko, where she's a very good technical striker, but you don't see anything super blistering dangerous about her. I'm like, I'm going to fucking fight favorite Ronda against any of these. You know, it really is weird that Ronda's basically faced the two chicks in her division that are really bad matchups. For this fight, it kind of underscores, in my opinion, just how shit women's MMA is, especially at 135. Like, Juliana Pena is, like, number three. Why the fuck is she number three? I know she's beat Kat Zingano, but
I mean, she hasn't lost in the UFC. She's 4-0 in the UFC.
Yeah, but look at her fucking, it's just like nothing super impressive. Like, for her to be number three?
Yeah.
It's just insane. Shevchenko's number two. At least Shevchenko beat.
Do you think when people do the rankings, they take into account that bar fight she got into?
Oh, they should. That's a good point.
I think she punched, like, two guys in the balls.
Yeah.
Maybe that counts.
And now she's here in Chicago, and I know exactly where she trains, too. It's 15 minutes away from me. But, I mean, and then, you know, Shevchenko, who, honestly, she was somebody, as I started prepping for this fight, just randomly getting myself hyped up, I was super impressed with, particularly in her debut fight against Sarah McMahon. I mean, she didn't just beat McMahon. She took her down maybe half a dozen times with trips and throws. She's way better on the feet. I'm like going,
was it Kaufman? Did she fight McMahon? I think you're thinking of Sarah Kaufman.
Oh, fuck, it's Sarah Kaufman. Yeah, that is so much less impressive. Never mind. I thought it was Sarah McMahon. I'm like, wow, she's really fucking tossing this Olympian around. I'm like, holy shit, that does make a lot more. Still, whatever.
Sorry.
Yeah, still.
Like, in that situation, should I just let you go with that?
No, it's better for me to look like an idiot. It's better humor. But you can say this about Shevchenko. Her UFC career has been against a former Strikeforce champion, against the current UFC champion, and then against the last UFC, second to last UFC champion. So, like, she's fought really good people. And obviously, she beat Holly Holm, and she got beat by Nunez, ironically, because she kind of slowed down as the fight went on. And Nunez was just bigger than her. So, I actually really just had this feeling, fuck it, me, man. Everything I thought, fuck me, Shevchenko's just going to run through Pena. She's a better striker. She can grapple better. Look at all the throws. But this is all through the prism of thinking she beat Sarah McMahon. Now I'm completely thrown off. I still don't really think Juliana Pena is all that good. Like, she's fine. She's passable. But nothing she does says to me dangerous. Like, you watch Amanda Nunes. There's things you go, oh shit, yeah, the way she could punch. Or see with Ronda or Holly Holm even. You know, you just be like, okay, there's things about her that you have to be very careful at. She's really super great at this. I don't see any of that with Pena. Like, her striking is blah. Her grappling is good, but her wrestling isn't all that good. And that's a really bad combination. When, like, the one thing you're really good at is something that requires you to get it to the ground. And, like, she'll play off her back too much and... She's won. She's doing what she needs to do. I can't fault it too much, but I haven't, like, seen her fight and been blown away going, wow, this is amazing. Plus, look at her two fights prior to coming to the UFC. She lost two in a row. So, again, it's just these are number two and number three. I don't know. Ronda, come back and get beat up some more.
I'm just, while you're talking, I'm reading, like, the incident report from that bar fight. I think we should just note this because I find it amusing. Basically, it says, an alleged victim and two witnesses told officers that Pena and Josh Gao, her training partner on the Sikjitsu fight team, attempted to enter Zola's bar after being involved in a street fight. Witnesses said Gao's face was covered in blood from the brawl and the two wanted to use the bathroom to get Gao cleaned up. Bar employees told Pena and Gao that the establishment was closed and that they could not come in, which prompted Pena to become irate, according to witnesses. They said that Pena kicked a bar employee in the groin and then, while outside the business, kicked the owner in the groin twice. Gao did not get physical with anyone, witnesses said, and was described as clearly being drunk. The two attempted to enter Zola's again, witnesses said, but they were locked out. Gao then rubbed his bloody face on the bar's front window, according to witnesses. Like,
she doesn't at all. I think she's a Venezuelan vixen. I think that's her nickname. Yeah, she doesn't at all fit the stereotype of an irrational, anger-prone Latina woman. No, not at all. Come, what the? Give her credit. She knows when you go up against a dude, punt him in the cock. She doesn't screw around with anything. Just goes right for the dick. Like. Somebody taught her some self-defense or something like that. Otherwise, these are the actions of well-balanced human beings.
I obviously side with the restaurant owners, considering my background, but it's like, if there were two people, one covered in blood, and another one screaming at me to let them in the restaurant, I would, like, immediately call the cops. I wouldn't say, oh, yeah, come on in. Like, I'd be like, you know what, I know you're in a bad spot right now, but I can't let you in here. Do you know what I mean? And then the owner of the place is probably, like, outside trying to calm him down, and she boots him in the nuts, not once, but twice. Like, that's a shitty shift.
Well, yeah, exactly. And it's kind of like one of those things where you always see the sign, we have the right to refuse anyone, but that doesn't really work because You can't refuse gay people. You can't refuse black people. You can't refuse women. Like,
liberal America.
But like, seriously, like, who else are you going to refuse? Like, that's who you're going to refuse. There's one exception. Bloody crazy people in your window, you have the unequivocal right to refuse, and no one's going to give you shit for it. Right. So, yeah, we found the people. They're the nobody wants them to be next to them at the bar or sitting at the next table as they offer, oh, waiter, can I get some more water and a napkin for my bloody eye over here? Thanks. Also, I'll take two steaks and one for my face. But I'm bumped.
In the semi-main event, although you could maybe call this a co-main and not
this
upset
would be co-main,
you.
Yes.
Okay, all right. We've got a welterweight fight with Donald Cerrone versus Jorge Masvidal. Kind of a good fight, but not the one I think Cerrone should have taken. To me, it's kind of a step backwards for Cerrone, considering his win streak at welterweight and how good he's looked at welterweight, and that he's really, I mean, he's always been a named fighter, but he's really on the verge of becoming a star. And this is kind of a risky fight for him because Masvidal's no joke. I favor Cerrone in this fight for sure, but it's not an easy win for Cerrone.
Yeah, I mean, I know we've been over this before, so anybody that actually listened to all these shows, you've heard it before. For the new one listener, hi. It's Cerrone. He's going to do what he's going to do. It's kind of funny that he's fighting again at welterweight against another dude that's really just a lightweight. He's beaten some legitimate welterweights, but this is almost like if he wins, Cerrone's got nothing to gain here except that he furthers his very legitimately earned reputation as a dude that will just fight fucking anyone at any time. Like, he just fought back in December, early December. He's fighting now. That means he'll probably be angling to fight at UFC 209 or 210 at the latest. Well, I mean, that's insane, but what else is he going to do? He's going to fight himself either into or out of a title shot. He's at the point where they're going to be like, dude, there's nobody left for you to fight. I don't know what you want us to do. Like, you're beating all the welter. Like, you're fighting so often, we can't find guys for you. So, whatever. It's fucking Donald Cerrone. He's going to go out there. He's probably better than Masvidal at everything. I think he's naturally a little bit bigger than Masvidal as well. Masvidal, I believe, at one point in his career, fought at 145. I think that Cerrone once said he could make 145 because he's an idiot. But I think Cerrone's just bigger, stronger, better. And he's just so in his zone right now. I think Cerrone is – I know I'm repeating myself, but he's just embraced who he is as a person. And I think that's helped so much with his life and with his fighting style. And I think he's so much better for it. When he just doesn't give a fuck, he's just going to have fun. He's like, man, I'm from Denver. I want to fight in Colorado. I want to fight in my hometown. I'm good to go. I just beat the shit out of Matt Brown, made it look easy. I'm going to do it with Masvidal as well. And it's he better win. It'll be sad if he doesn't because he deserves to. And if he loses, he doesn't deserve to win then. Who cares?
It was funny. Cerrone was on Luke Thomas's show on Sirius, XM, whatever that weird initial thing is now. But
WMEI?
Yeah, something. Some kind of dot
Thomas FM. Has a show on that?
Huh. Yeah. But he was interviewing Cerrone, and he goes, how do you manage to fight four times in 2013, four times in 14, four times in 15, and now like four times every year and never get hurt? And Cerrone's response was, I'm always hurt. I just fight anyway. Exactly. It was like so classic Cerrone. And then Thomas pushed it a little further. He even said, well, how do you get the license to fight? Aren't there medicals? And he goes, yeah, when the doctors check me, they run me through the test and I tell them I feel fine. It's just like, okay. It kind of just shed a light on guys who pull out of fights. It's like, if you really want to fight, you probably can weasel your way into it. And I'm not saying that's the smart thing to do or you should do it, but if you really want to fight, Cain Velasquez, you probably could.
Well, for fuck's sake, when one guy on the undercard of Bellator got suspended for 45 whole days because they revealed a pre-fight stabbing wound that he had hid from them that had come opened up during a fight. Like, if you can hide being stabbed stabbed from an athletic commission doctor. We're not exactly dealing with the Mayo Clinic here. Like, these people are fucking incompetent. I mean, Johns Hopkins not knocking on the door of the doctor that said, all right, touch your nose. All right, can you balance? All right, do you have any lethal stabbing wounds that are open? Nope. No, okay, move on. Like, what the fuck? Like, yeah, if you want to fight, you can fight. And I'm not saying, you know, certain guys have certain injuries which are just, it's impossible to fight a torn ACL or whatever.
Sure. Behind.
But if they wanted to, they could probably hide it from the athletic commission. I remember Chuck hid the MCL tear from them. And again, this dude Bellator just hit a stabbing wound. This isn't like something internal. There was an opening in his body that he received when another human being stabbed him with a knife. And setting aside the dangers of hepatitis or whatever that other one is, some sort of tetanus, the fact that he's involved in a world where you get stabbed is weird, because I don't live in the world where I have to fear people stabbing me. I mean, it could happen by random chance. I doubt this was a random chance with this guy. And then you're like, yeah, I'm going to still do a cage fight. What? And then nobody noticed? How do you not know that a man has been stabbed? It's not something internal. It's not like he's faking, oh, I'm hiding my cold, or I'm hiding my cracked skull if you're Tito. He's got a puncture wound in his body. All you had to do was look at him for a little bit, and you should have seen a stab wound. Clearly, they saw it after the fight. Somehow, I got suspended for having a stab wound. That's the greatest thing I've ever heard. That's the best suspension ever. USADA couldn't screw that one up. USADA would never in a million years be like, well, you're going to get 18 months for hiding a stabbing from us. It'd be amazing. So, oh, yeah, you can do anything.
Also on the main card on this Fox show, we've got Andre Arlovski, the grizzled old veteran, taking on Francis Ngannou. Ngannou is a guy who's on the upswing, too. We were talking about Derek Lewis in the heavyweight division. Ngannou hasn't really fought anybody good, but right now he's, 4-0 in the UFC. Granted, it's lower-level guys he's fighting. This is a big step up in competition for him. Arlovski himself is, I believe, coming off a loss, right?
Yeah, to Josh Burnett.
Yeah, Arlovski needs to win big. He's actually lost 3 in a row. TKO to Miocic, TKO to Overeem, and submission to Barnett. If you wonder what would happen if Arlovski loses his fight, if they cut him, where he's still a big enough name where they don't want him going to Bellator, or where their heads would be at with that. But 4 losses in a row for Arlovski would not be ideal at this point in his career.
Yeah, it's weird because he's lost 4 in a row. They were all decisive losses. But just in typical Arlovski fashion, he's always looked good at times in those fights.
Sure.
Everyone, you know, especially Josh Barnett, there's times where I'm like, oh, he's going to beat Barnett. I'm like, this is really something special here. The Overeem fight, maybe not as much, but, you know, he's always been kind of competitive, but he's had the same weaknesses he's had throughout his career. His chin's just shit, and now he's getting older, so it's even worse. But look at that 3 in a row. If he loses, this would be 4. This would be to a guy that you can excuse the other fights. They're all basically world title holders or challengers at one time. So you can be like, whatever, he's fighting the best of the best. Francis Ngannou is not. I'm pretty sure that after his fight, actually, back in December in Albany, not the other one, I think Arlovski was one of the guys we had said he should fight. So we're very smart in that way, as everyone knows. And, he looked good. I remember he did the roll of Kimura. Mm-hmm. So,
I mean, Ngannou, every fight's been a finish for him. 3 knockouts and 1 submission. So I feel like he's a strong dude. He just doesn't have a lot of experience at all against top-level guys. I mean, he's 9-1 overall, but he hasn't fought anybody. The best guy he's fought is Anthony Hamilton, who no one even knows. So it'll be interesting to see if he can, you know, close the distance and box with Arlovski, who granted doesn't have a great chin, but is a legit striker where he at times looks like the best striker in the heavyweight division.
Yeah, it's I like it. It's a good fight. I'm happy to see it. It's free, so I'm really happy to see it. Arlovsky's one of the guys that doesn't have a style that I think would exploit the wisdom that comes with being around the sport for a long time. You know, Josh Barnett does, or Randy Couture did, Yargo Velasquez does, or whatever. But Arlovsky still fights like a fast twitch fighter. He still fights like a guy who is a really great boxer, which he was back in the day. He doesn't do, you know, the little things that you kind of pick up over time. So in that sense, like, his style-wise, he's just like a slow version of what could be a problem for Francis there, but he's just old, and I would just have to guess that he loses. And it's more that Arlovsky loses than anything. But you know what? I say that, but he's at 39. At a certain point, when that happens so often in your life, yeah, you can look really good hitting mitts and hitting pads and look in certain fights look like a world beater, but you gotta fucking do it. You know, you just can only make excuses. Well, actually, you can make excuses forever because Vitor, BJ, and Arlovsky have all made careers out of that, so I don't know.
Opening the show is Alex Caceres first. Jason, not the jobber from ECW, Knight.
That's exactly who I thought it was at first, too.
That I would pay to see. That I would buy. Jason Knight, he was like a manager in ECW. Not a very good one, if memory serves me. I think he managed the pit bulls. But anyway, that's the opener on the card. On the prelim portion on Fox Sports 1, we've got a Nate Marquardt, Sam Alvey fight at middleweight. Rafael Assuncao versus Aljamain Sterling.
That's good.
A good bantamweight fight. Top 10 guys there. Maybe you could argue maybe even top 5 if you pushed it. Then a lot of, I want to say, garbage.
You got a lot of people that don't have Wikipedia entries.
That's true. I mean, I know Eric Spicely's coming off a nice submission win a couple months back. But a lot of these guys you've never heard of and don't really care about, so we can probably end the UFC on Fox preview right there. Then we should probably talk about stuff a little bit, but we can – oh, there's a Submission Underground this weekend too. Chael was supposed to be on it. Will you watch Submission Underground 3?
No.
No. No. Even considering that you like jiu-jitsu and do it,
I think
no
it's
interest
on,
in that.
I think it's on Flow, so I think I have to pay for it. I'm not going to pay for watching grappling match, especially not shit that guys don't even care about. If I was going to pay for, like, you know, John Jones didn't give a shit about that, and he still
won. Right.
If I was going to pay for anything, it would be watching the, you know, true Jiu-Jitsu World Championships or Abu Dhabi or something like that. And I still wouldn't pay for that. I would just watch it when it gets released on YouTube and a week or two later because... Even jiu-jitsu, like, I don't know who half these guys fucking are, so I just want to watch.
You don't want to watch Gordon Ryan and Jeff Monson?
Take a small guy and a big guy, and let's see what happens.
Dylan Danis versus AJ Agerzarm?
Actually, that's a really good match. Dylan and AJ are two super-duper high-level guys, but they're also, like, new-breed guys that they don't do classic jiu-jitsu. They're not doing position before submission. A lot of leg locks and fancy stuff. That's actually really good. But, I mean, again, I'm sure I can find clips of them competing against one another on YouTube already.
Right.
And it'll be on YouTube eventually anyway, so I'll get to watch all of it and see what's going on. And it's fucking jiu-jitsu. These are matches that don't even really matter.
I'll give you one more.
Okay.
How about Jeff Glover versus Chad Mendes? That's weird.
That's really good. That is weird.
Jeff Glover does, like, cartwheels and stuff, right? Isn't he, like, all over the place?
He uses what's called the donkey guard, which isn't really a guard, but literally turn your back, bend over, and grab touch the ground kind of like a donkey would, and you will kick your hind legs out almost in an attempt to, like, do, like, a weird reverse guard thing and try and transition to leg locks and shit like that. It works for him at times just because... Nobody does it, and if you're unorthodox, you can give guys who aren't super elite trouble. You know, Chad's obviously Chad. Submission wise, I mean, Jeff Glover's he should win the match, I would think.
Sure. We can quickly touch on some stuff. I know we're running long here again, but this is MMA and stuff. New president in office, Donald Trump, President Trump. Thoughts on his job performance thus far?
I don't know.
I know you didn't like Obama's executive orders, but Trump is putting them out there pretty quick.
The whole thing is just weird for me. Some of the executive orders he's done, I'm not a fan of, but like, if you're undoing a previous executive order, fine. I really like some of the shit Obama did at the end. I thought like when Obama signed the executive order halting the construction of the Keystone Pipeline, I thought that was just pathetic, cowardice horseshit. Because that whole thing got built, $3 billion worth got built, everything was approved during his entire tenure in office, and then with like 12 days to go, or whatever, like, you know, maybe 3 weeks or some shit, he's like, oh, I'm going to stop it now, just so he can look really good, knowing full well that Trump will come in and reinstate it, and then both of their oil buddies who've bought them off or whatever will be happy. So I thought that was horse shit. Rhonda probably doesn't agree, but I don't care what she says. I'm a winner. I mean, Trump overall, like, I don't know. Look at this way. There's never been a fucking guy who's ever been running for president, and like, after like a week, literally everyone has discussed every movement he's made. Like, I know that early on in the presidency, guys do get more attention. Sure, that's the whole principle behind the first 100 days, but like, this whole thing with Trump, it's like a totally different level of interest. Nobody's ever given a fuck about politics this much. And now we're all watching the world's weirdest reality TV show.
I think part of it, too, is the social media aspect of it. Granted, social media existed 8 years ago, but it was a much different landscape. People have the shit on their phones now where it's like they're seeing his tweets, they're seeing Facebook posts, there's memes all over the place. It's a different dynamic than Obama's first 100 days. Like, Facebook was just getting off the ground, and we kind of take it for granted that Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all this stuff has been around forever, but it's relatively new still, even though it's been, you know, 7-8 years. So Trump's the first president to come into office and make sudden changes and have this sort of dynamic where people are getting their news immediately. It's more convenient. People aren't waiting to get their newspaper thrown in their yard the next day and read about it. They get it immediately on their lunch break or while they're sitting on the train or whatever they might be doing. I think there's a different level of engagement than there was in the past.
Yeah, again, from ignoring what he's actually done or not done, because it's
been remains very, to be seen.
It's been it's a weird first week when he, the head of the AFL-CIO, the biggest union in the world, or in the United States, you know, solid Democrats of all time, release a super positive statement about how much they like what Donald Trump did. Like, that didn't happen with any other Republican. Like, this is weird bedfellows happening here.
Right.
But I think there's a lot to be said for, I would say FDR was the president of the radio, JFK was the president of television, Trump is the president of the internet. Or at least of especially of social media. Obama was kind of like, you could argue Obama at the end was kind of the YouTube president, but Trump is the tweeting president. Like, he just owns that, and it's weird. He says things are dumb, they're stupid, inappropriate, and I hate using the words inappropriate or offensive, but, like, just mind-boggling. Like, you don't say, like, I visited the CIA today. When? Like, what do you mean, when? You're the fucking commander-in-chief. Like, they're going to have to do whatever you say, in theory. You know, what do you mean you won? You won a visit with spies? You don't win. You already won. It's such a weird thing to say, and yet it fits with the way Trump is. And as soon as I heard that, I go, I kind of know what he's trying to tell people. He's trying to tell people, hey, look, I said shit about the CIA. I said that they were against me. But now I visited with them. I used my charm, and I won them over. That's what he's really saying. He's really just communicating to people of, hey, look, everybody, you know what I'm talking about. I went in there. I talked to the director of the CIA, made a huge deal. Now they're on my side. Like, that's exactly how he's just portraying these things, and it's fascinating because it's also working. Like, I sometimes make an analogy that he's like a magician distracting with one hand. And, oh, look at the dumb thing I said. And he's signing all this shit over here on the side. But I read an article today from the New York Times because everybody's been fascinated by Trump the man. Like, everything is, it's not always just about the policy. It's about why is he doing it? Why did he tweet about Chicago? Oh, he was home alone at that time, and he probably saw something on Bill O'Reilly, and that's why he tweeted that he's going to do something about Chicago. And even though what he said was stupid, it couldn't constitutionally happen, I think it's so relatable, because if you're just a regular bloke sitting on your couch and you're watching TV and you're seeing about gang violence in Chicago, you know, you're going to tweet, yeah, man, if I was president, I'd fucking step in there and do something. He's doing that, I think, but forgetting that he's president. And it's just interesting, though, because the piece I read in the New York Times, they went, it was, you have to kind of read the lines, because the Times is leftist, Trump doesn't get good press from anyone, so if anything is positive about him, I assume must be super positive. Maybe I'm just buying into Trump's narrative, and if so, he's doing what he needs to do. But the whole piece is essentially, Donald Trump is already, every day this week he's had dinners. He brought in the heads of, like, big businesses everywhere, energy, cars, whatever. He brought in all the congressional leaders for a dinner. Elon Musk said he liked Trump's choice for Secretary of State, and people were like, "Ooh." And, but again, the thing with Trump is that he's using the White House to entertain people because that's what Trump likes to do. He likes to hobnob. He wants people to tell him he's special. And they said Barack Obama was famous for not doing that. That leaders would get upset that he wouldn't do the little things around Hollywood, around town, which I sympathize with. But they talked about how, like, Truman would have a weekly card game, and it was no politics talked about. It was just a way to build a rapport with people and kind of get to know them so that when the time came that you had to ask something of them, you were kind of on friendly terms. And I can already see Trump, that's what he's trying to do. He's working deals. He's going in there, he's going to fucking try to do a charm offensive on these guys. And he's a sociopath, and I don't know, maybe at work. With Trump, everybody keeps saying everything is wrong. He's doing it wrong. He's doing it wrong. He's doing it wrong. And I say it. I go, that's not the way to do it. You'll never make it a month. You'll never make it 6 months. You'll never get the nomination. You'll never win. You'll never do this. It's like every time Trump does something, it works. I don't know why. I don't know how. I don't know if he's doing something new and different. Or if he's going to be in jail in 6 months, that's probably more likely. But at a certain point, I've just said, I don't understand. Everybody who's ever predicted anything about him has been wrong. I'm just going to sit there and watch and go, I don't know. The dude's, maybe he is the smartest guy of all time. I don't know. He's 70. He's a multi-billionaire, and he's president, and his wife is hot. He's kind of made it all happen.
Yeah, I mean, I shouldn't say the only thing, but one of the only things, like, I respect about him is he's doing what he said he was going to do. He's being unconventional. He's not Washington. He said he's going to build a wall. He said he was going to ban Muslims. And he's at least making overtures to do all those things. I don't agree with any of that stuff, but he's doing what he said he would. And a lot of politicians give lip service and say they're going to do stuff and then either just say it to get elected or just aren't capable of getting it done or don't push hard enough to get it done. So in that regard, like, you got to give the guy a little bit of respect, even if what he's doing is fucked up.
Yeah. And it's weird because, again, my instinct says this bites Trump on the ass. Like, this is not going to work. Everybody, you have to be a politician because they all do. Everybody has to give a little and wheel and deal and make all these things or whatever. But maybe Trump is just coming at it from the attitude of, well, and I know we talked about this in private. It's basically, I sold somebody something, so I have to give it to them. You know, right. If I sell you a green car, here's a green car. I don't care if I like green cars. I said I'd give you a green car. He sold people a wall. He's like, so in Trump's mind, he's like, well, I said I'd give him a wall, so I got to give him a wall. That's just what he's going to do. And it's weird because we're all taken aback by behavior, which really should be very common. Like, we should all be like, well, that's what the guy said he was going to do, so now he's going to do it. That should not be a surprise that it took Donald Trump to do that in Washington
is a really scary proposition and says a lot about what's going on in our great nation's capital.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if this thousands of miles of wall actually gets built, and how it gets paid for and all that. It's not like it's a done deal, but he's headed in that direction. So, again,
it'll be done in 6 months. Whatever it is, it'll be done in 6 months. It won't even be a full wall. It'll be like 2 miles of bricks and then like a bunch of security cameras. It'll be like, look, I got it done. The wall's there. It works. We're moving on. Because Trump wants to satisfy these things immediately. He moves from one thing to another, to another, to another, to another. He's governing the way he campaigned. He campaigned so that no one scandal would ever catch up with him because there'd be another one to replace it. And it's mm-hmm. the same thing he's doing with governing. I'm going to sign this. Putting in the gag rule, the Mexico gag rule on abortions, or I'm going to bring jobs in from overseas. I'm going to get rid of TPP. I'm going to build a wall. I'm going to cut this tax. I'm going to do this. Like, he moves so fast that nobody has a chance to get out there and make a big deal out of any one issue.
Right.
He's doing so many issues. Like, it's actually a really smart way to do things, and that's why, like I say, at this point, I'm just going, I don't know what the fuck's going on. Up is down and down is up and left is right and right is center. I don't get how the world works anymore. I'm done. I don't know. I'm just
tapping out.
I'm just holding on and hoping that we don't spin too fast.
In a related topic, Ronda Rousey was spotted at Standing Rock to support the Sioux Tribe's protests against the Dakota Access oil pipeline that is still going on. She brought them some food and supplies and says she's willing to get pepper sprayed in the face to help them. You have roots in the Dakotas, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
Will you be joining Rhonda in protest?
No, because I have roots in the Dakotas. I mean, I know that she does too, actually. And I understand that she's in Hollywood. She's got to do, like, liberal kind of lefty causes now. It's just, that's the game. And I don't think she objects to them either. Like, I'm sure that's where she lies. And so she's found one that works for her. Like, it's in the news. It kind of gives you your credibility. And she probably cares about it. You know, she's grew up in North Dakota for a long time, and she knows the people there. And she has real roots and connections to it, which is more than you can say about almost every other person protesting in North Dakota. She can at least be like, hey, I fucking lived here. So, yeah, it works. I mean, whatever, it's her cause, and she can be
right. Clearly not your cause, though.
Honestly, I don't give a shit. I think that the tribes involved have been duplicitous because they just purposely did not show up at meetings. They were given adequate, and they had 18 months to raise objections. They were offered money, and they just never responded. They would actually set meetings at the casino, because, yeah, in the stereotype, the chief sets his meetings at the casino, which is only not funny anymore because the president of the United States used to have his meetings at a casino. So, but they would set a meeting and then cancel the meeting. And then it was only, like, after all the companies involved had shelled out literally billions of dollars, so that obviously they were saying gambling pot committed. Then all of a sudden it was, oh, we need to stop this, and then everybody's like, oh, we got really involved, and this is really dangerous, and, like, it's dangerous in theory. And then they tried out shit like, they literally said, like, happy hunting grounds and our sacred grounds and all this stuff, and I'm like, this, last I checked, this is America. Don't we have that separation of church and state everyone talks about? We're now making decisions based on what somebody calls a sacred hunting ground. Not like a cemetery. They're calling this sacred hunting ground. This is bullshit. You don't get to make up laws based on somebody else's sacred hunting ground. That's how Israel and Palestine are working right now, because they both have some magical fucking figure that told them, yeah, you get Jerusalem, now you get Jerusalem. And then they have to fucking argue over it. It's fucking retarded. So, but again, if people want to fucking protest, I don't care anymore. They're going to do it. It's not going to stop anything, and their protesting won't hurt my life. So, I don't know. If this makes Rhonda feel good about being a shitty fighter, so be it.
Okay. We've got a Super Bowl coming up, not this coming Sunday, but the following one. New England Patriots versus the Atlanta Falcons. Who do you like in the game?
Well, we'll probably talk about it again next week, but my first gut instinct is just the Patriots.
Okay.
I mean, Belichick and Brady, they're arguably the greatest combination in a duo in NFL history. The only people who approach it would be Bill Walsh and Joe Montana, probably. I mean, those two are just like this, just this unstoppable fucking force. So there's 7 Super Bowl in 15 years. That's fucking insane.
Right.
Like, that'd be insane in baseball or basketball, and those are sports designed to create legacies. Like, you don't have this kind of dominance in football. I mean, yes, you have. The 70s were run by the Steelers, the 80s by the Niners, the 90s kind of by probably the Cowboys. But this is like 2 decades worth. This is not 4 Super Bowls in 6 years. Like, 7 and 15 is insane. And nothing fazes them. Brady doesn't get hit. He doesn't take dumb punishment. I'm looking at you, Cam Newton, and every other quarterback that's kind of mobile. Stop being mobile. I mean, he's so good at reading everything and deciphering defenses. And Belichick, yeah, look, these guys, I don't want to call them cheaters. It's so easy to say, oh, they cheat and they deflate gate and this and that. It's like, fuck, first of all, every coach in the league is trying to do this stuff. They're all trying to videotape and record things. If they succeed at it, so be it. And what they've been accused of doing, these are minor things. It's not like they're out there like, and they're throwing spitballs. They're not out there they don't have a reputation of being dirty. Like, you never hear about the Patriots as being guys who go after the knees or the head or anything like that. They're always just a solid football team. So, and to me, the Falcons are a team that I'm like, at the beginning of the year, I would have been like, maybe they'll win their division, but I don't really see it. I know they're kind of like a modern day, greatest show on turf, if you will, from the reference to the old St. Louis Rams. Sorry, St. Louis. High-powered offense, and their defense is held up, but it's crunch time, man. It's Bill Belichick and Tom Brady, and they're not facing the Giants. They're probably going to win the Super Bowl.
Yeah, to me it's a question of whether Matt Ryan can kind of rise to the occasion. Because, I mean, he's always a good quarterback. He's always had good offensive threats, but it's like he's never really been able to get over the hump and be, you know, a Brady or Rodgers, a Manning, that kind of level quarterback. So I don't want to say it's make or break for him, but who knows when you're going to get to the Super Bowl again. It's kind of a legacy-defining moment for Matt Ryan, too.
Well, if you're the Patriots, you know it's every other year, but I understand what you're saying, yeah. Every other year in football, on average – through most people's like lifetime now, the Patriots have been in the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
That's insane. They were a shit team for years. I remember growing up thinking the Patriots sucked, and now they are the gold standard of all organizations.
Well, it was funny. Obviously, I live in New England, so I've watched the team pretty closely over the years. But, I mean, they were in the 85 Super Bowl against your Chicago Bears, and they got destroyed, just totally demolished. That Bears team was nasty. And then they were in a Super Bowl with Bledsoe, and they lost to the Packers. And then since Brady took over the team in 01, they've won the division every year except once, which was in 02. They've won the division 14 times with Brady. And then even they didn't win the division in 08 because Brady, that was the year he tore his ACL, and they had to go first game of the year, he tore his ACL, was out the whole season. Backup quarterback Matt Castle went 11-5, and the Patriots were the first team in like 40 years to not make the playoffs at 11-5.
And then they flipped Castle for a bunch of picks, and Castle became a dud.
Yeah,
genius.
That's always not always the question around here, but people question, is Brady that good, or is it the system and Belichick, who's this genius? But if you look at Belichick's career, he did nothing with the Browns, so there's something about that combination of him and Brady that seems unstoppable. But even without Brady, they went 11-5, and then this year they were 3-1 without him when he was suspended for cheating with his balls.
Yeah, well, you know, we all cheat with our balls. We all want to, you know, inflate them as big as we can get them. It happens. It's the first thing we'll do one day with stem cells. You know, the thing is, I think at this point now,
Brady doesn't need Belichick to be great and vice versa. But I don't think that they could have gotten to the point where they are right now without each other. Like, I think you put Brady in the Bears for the beginning of his career, and he's out of the game. He wouldn't have had the people, you know, the right coaches to develop him and protect him and, you know, turn him into a football genius. Because even though the guy is dumb as a fucking box of rocks, you know, he fucking has a Donald Trump hat in his locker. Do you support Trump? Oh, I don't really want to talk about that. Like, you fucking moron. And Giselle is telling him, shut up and stop talking in the public. You know, he knows football as well as anybody except for maybe Peyton Manning. But it's because he got to learn under a pro like Belichick. And Belichick similarly benefited by having a really good, you know, physically gifted quarterback in Tom Brady to tutor. And they were just, you know, the perfect fit. And I think, you know, it's one of those things where coaches, and it's fine, it's the nature of the game, but they don't get time to make mistakes. You think about, like, any job, really, it takes you 5, 10, 15 years to get, you know, even halfway decent at a job. It just takes a long time. And I would imagine it's the same thing with being a head coach in football. You know, these guys come in there, and the first time they're around, you know, if you're Belichick, you're coaching the Browns, and it doesn't work out well. Well, that's because you hadn't done it before. And sometimes guys might be really good coaches. They just need the right personnel around them. Because let's face it, there's never really been a great coach who didn't have somebody special on their team. There's always somebody. You know, Dick had the entire defense. Walsh had Montana. Johnson had Aikman and all those guys. And obviously, you know, Belichick and Brady. It's the only guy that's ever been an exception has been Peyton Manning, who never really seemed to have, like, a strong, strong coach behind him. Otherwise, they're all entangled in one another. It's the nature of the beast.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, too, because when players leave the Patriots, like, they always groom these backup quarterbacks, and they always get starting jobs in other teams, and they almost always fail. It's like none of them ever really pan out, whether it's Ryan Mallett or Matt Castle or I'm trying to think of the other guy's name.
Almost
but
everybody on defense, they just say every year, fuck it, you're out, we're going to bring in somebody new, and it'll work just as well.
It's crazy because they, like, I want to say they dismantled the defense this year, but they let go of Chandler Jones, and he had that marijuana, that fake whatever.
The spice.
Whatever it was, he showed up at the police station with his shirt off and was all fucked up, and they basically traded him on the spot. And they've let a couple other guys go and just not re-sign them, where you're like, holy shit, the defense is going to fall apart, and has been fine. But even, like, their assistant coaches and stuff leave and don't do that well. Like, Josh McDaniels didn't do well in Denver. Charlie Weiss left and didn't do much. Romeo Crennel left and didn't do much. Eric Mangini failed with the Jets. It's just like all these people come and go, and it's like it has no effect on the Patriots, whether it's coaches, players, whatever. Somehow they just keep the ball moving. And you would think you'd have to credit Belichick, but when you watch Belichick talk and stuff, he's just so robotic and comes off like such a douchebag that you wonder.
That means he's smart. He's like Popovich. Popovich does the same thing. Where it's just like he looks at it and he goes, this is such a dumb fucking waste of my time. What am I going to do, sit out here and be like, oh, yeah, we discovered a complete and obvious weakness in the Falcons' defense. Here's what it is. All right, there's your cover.
Let's go lose. With Popovich, though, I feel like he's got some charm, and he'll joke around and like, acknowledges that it's a joke. But there's no sense of humor with Belichick. I don't see Belichick. He's an X's and O's guy, I guess. He's not, like,
he's not a rah-rah.
He's not Rex Ryan. He's not a rah-rah coach. He's going to give this speech and get all the guys motivated and slamming chairs in the locker room and running out at halftime ready to kill somebody. Like, it's just interesting that he's been as successful as he is considering what appear to be major shortcomings.
I think it's just, you know, it shows that leadership takes all shapes and sizes. It's like, you know, people gave Cam Newton shit because he wasn't a traditional quarterback, but I saw the way that he was out on the field, and it brings in a racial component to it, but I'm like, he's leading the way that I feel like works with a black community. He's being, you know, charismatic and outgoing, and he's clapping and dancing and singing. Like, you look at him, you go, it's kind of like the difference between, like, a white priest and a black pastor. He's acting like a black pastor. and Tom Brady acts like a white priest. Like, it's just people are used to different types of leadership. I think it's the same with Belichick versus Rex Ryan or any of these other guys, because he doesn't show the outward charisma. But he's probably a very – he's probably somebody that every one of those players knows doesn't lie to them. He doesn't call – he doesn't say shit. And they know – look, at the end of the day, he just puts his hand down and goes, by the way, look at all these fucking rings. By the way, I only wait 1 year in between Super Bowl appearances. And they just go, oh, yeah, I'm just going to do whatever this dude says, because he probably – look, he makes them all good. He makes them all better than they were before. Like, and like you put up before – you take guys who are level 5, he makes them into a level 7 and convinces the league to pay him that way. These guys all get paid, and then when he's not there to help them up, they revert back. So, you know, I think a lot of guys would be like, I'll do what coach says, and I'm going to make me a lifetime of money.
Yeah, I don't want to call him the GM. I don't know if he has that official title, but he's in charge of the personnel and has a lot of impact on contracts and that sort of thing. Just some of the moves he's made over the years, like you scratch your head at the time, like letting Jamie Collins go for a third round pick. But there must have been something with Jamie Collins, who was like the super athletic linebacker, the type of guy who would, you know, jump the line and block a field goal, that sort of guy, who was probably going to be like the foundation of the linebacking core on the team, just lets him go for a third round pick. But it's like, they still went 14-2 this year and went to the Super Bowl and dominated the AFC in the playoffs. It's just amazing. And over the years, whether it's like bringing in Randy Moss after he was on the Raiders and looked terrible, and then they have that 07 season where they go 16-0, and granted they lost in the Super Bowl. It's just that sort of thing. I don't want to say he's a step ahead of everybody else in the league, but he's kind of got this vision where he'll think outside the box and take a chance. And obviously for the most part, it's paid off.
Yeah. He's just, a master at X's and O's, no doubt. It's easy to do a lot of this when you have the security blanket and Brady. And also I think he's just brilliant at, recognizing talent and figuring out exactly why. Like, he knows why a play works. And not just like, oh, this guy made the block, but why did that guy make the block? Why was he in that position? Should he have been in that position? Did we really deserve to win this game? Like, you see this a lot more in soccer than you do in America, American sports. But, like, a lot of times the game will end 1-1 or something like that, or tied up, and the guy would be – and everybody will say one team was clearly better. And it's just accepted that, you know, teams will lose games that they – absolutely should have won way more than you see in America, because obviously they have, you know, 0-0 draws, but people be like, oh yeah, that it was like a 0-0 draw is equivalent to a 4-0 blowout. And I think Belichick is just so far ahead in that same sense of he knows why he should have won it. But he probably in his back of his mind knows exactly what the score of the game should have been if guys had done what they were supposed to do at a certain time.
Late-breaking news, nothing exciting, don't get it too worked up, but we have another fight for UFC 210. Main event was just announced. We've got Daniel Cormier versus Anthony Johnson, number 2, finally. That's the show in Buffalo we talked about earlier. So you've got Cormier and Rumble, and then underneath, for now, we've got Weidman versus Musasi.
That's a good pay-per-view.
Yeah, not bad. I don't know if it'll sell, but... That Rumble Cormier rematch is the top two light heavyweights in the world.
Let's take a place in John Jones's hometown.
Interesting, isn't that?
It's either Buffalo or Albany.
Yeah, I think it's Utica actually, but
that's
upstate
one of
New
those
York.
Two. I don't know. Yeah, those are both upstate New York to me in my mind.
Anything that's not New York City is upstate.
It's just kind of like in Illinois. If it's not Chicago, it's just there. They're all the same. We have Chicago, and then we have, like, a little bit west, and then just south. And I didn't even realize how far south Illinois goes. We go down to Tennessee. We touch on part of, like, Alabama or Arkansas or some shit like that. I'm like, holy shit, there's some real hillbillies in this state.
On that note, I've got nothing else. Did we miss anything?
Oh, we missed tons of stuff, but we've been going on for way too long.
Okay.
I could rant about the women's marches. Actually, I don't really have a problem with the marches, but...
Go ahead. What's the issue?
Oh, just Madonna performing. Like, I, she, I, just,
She just fucking shows up where there's a big, large group of women, and so she can sing and pretend like she's relevant. But she's so useless. Like, she's like a sex symbol, and then she complains, oh, nobody appreciates older women in Hollywood. It's like, bitch, you fucking made a living because you were attractive. Like, you got what you had because you sold sex, and nobody wants to see a 60-year-old having sex. No, 60-year-olds don't. That's why they watch. That's why there's a lot of barely legal porn and not barely alive porn. All right, just shut up, Mandana. That's a good line. I like that.
I do. Some of the women's signs were funny. I think women might make better signs than men. Especially going to like wrestling shows over the year. Not a lot of clever men making signs. Some of the women's signs were actually pretty funny.
Yeah, no, some of the signs were fine. They were pretty good. You know, all due credit to the women. It seems to be just a magnificently, I don't want to say well organized, because I heard it was actually very disorganized. They just kind of like, in the sense of, they vastly underestimated the numbers of people. Like here in Chicago, they were going to have a march, but it had to turn into like a, I'll say a gathering, because they just had way more people show up than they expected. I heard, like, in L.A., they thought they'd have 80,000. They had 800,000. So it was just way bigger than they really expected it to be. And yet, there's no real – there were problems in D.C., I guess, with some rioting. But for the most part, there was not really any big issues at all. Like, when they fucking had the – it's going to sound really bad. I don't care. When they had the Black Lives Matter type of riots and protests in Milwaukee, there was way more damage and arrest than – women did across the entire globe, which is just crazy. So, you know, they marched, and I don't know exactly what for. They don't really know exactly what for. But, you know, even if it's just to, like, remind men of, hey, be nice to women, that's fine. That's a good march. There's something admirable about that. Maybe, you know, sometimes as dudes need to be just reminded of, pay attention to your woman. Pay attention to the ladies out there and be nice to them.
Yeah, two of my favorites was, one was, this is so bad, even introverts are here. And the other one was, I've seen better cabinets at IKEA. Those two just made me laugh.
My favorite was the idiot woman that had the sign that said, I want to live in a world where women have as many rights as guns.
I'm saw that one. That
it's
one
like, oh, yeah? Done. You want to be able to not go into schools, not go into airplanes, not be allowed in the government? Like, yeah, let's think this one through a little bit there, honey. Like, come on. Like, that's always been my thing, is like, if you want to just fuck with people, just make gun laws and abortion laws the exact same. If you think the 72-hour waiting period for an abortion is good, it's good for buying a gun. If you think that showing people pictures of babies getting mutilated or whatever and an abortion is good, then you should have to show people what it looks like when someone gets shot in the head. You know, just go back and forth. You have to, if you're 17, you want to buy a gun, you need parental consent. 17, when you have an abortion, parental consent. The same principle applies. They're both, you know, in theory, positive rights. So, yeah, go with it. I solve all kinds of problems this way. No, just nobody will fucking listen to me. But I will say, there could be breaking news next Thursday, or is it tomorrow, this Thursday, whenever Trump announces his Supreme Court nomination. I'm just saying, everybody, I may not be long for this podcast.
I think you can still squeeze it in. Other than that, I think we covered it all here. We're running long.
Yeah.
So thanks for listening to MMA and Stuff with myself, Matt. The other guy was Mike on halfguarded.com. We will talk again next week.
Aggressively, we all defend the role we play. Regrettably, times come to send you on your way. We've seen it all, bonfires of trust, flash floods of pain. It doesn't really matter, don't you worry, it'll all work out. No, it doesn't even matter, don't you worry, that ain't what it's all about.
We hope you enjoy your stay.